earth-shattering this. We do strive to be open and accessible here on this program, and to be available for constructive criticism. During the last segment, I received an email from a gentleman, M. McManus. His email address might give some clue as to what he is interested in. His email address is Illuminati. 63, I will not give the web URL, web service. This is what he wrote me, and so I must, of course, stand corrected. Attacking young H men, H as in the letter, lowercase, men, isn't a pedophile, it's a homosexual predator. Get that straight. There were no toddlers involved here. So I'm going to stand corrected. I have no idea what that means or how it relates to any of the stories. There were H men. They were Hadesic, but that had nothing to do with pedophilia or being a homosexual predator. There was a story of a homosexual predator. That would have been Cardinal O'Brien, but that wasn't necessarily pedophilia, because his victims were typically seminary students. And then there was a story of pedophilia related to Ratzinger, covering it up for years. But the big issue with that story, the current story, is a victimless crime, which is homosexual priests buying sexual services in the Vatican from male prostitutes. And so I'm not quite able to put the pieces together or tie that into the Illuminati. But whatever I said that might have been bleeding, I certainly apologize.
No, it's just like the Illuminati. It's right up their alley. The answer is somewhere in that email. We just have to,
okay.
We just have to look at it long enough to figure it out.
Okay. All right, well, I'm going to assign you that that responsibility as our gifted producer. We're going to return to the story of the creation account. We have been spending considerable time these last couple of days trying to ascertain the insights, prophetic insights that can be gleaned from it. Before I do that, I did have a brief conversation with Scott during the commercial break regarding God's ability to predict the future. And Scott's comment was, when the asteroid by the right name and the right size is going to arrive on exactly the day that he said, and I say right size because God specifies the damage that's going to be caused by this asteroid, and the size of the asteroid that is hitting is large enough not to to wipe out the entire Earth and all life on it, but it is a continent killer. It is large enough to do that. It will do the kind of damage that God specified. It is called by the name that God said it would be named, and it is arriving on the exact day that he said it was going to arrive, and it will have to be nudged ever so slightly to impact the Earth. That it's probably not a coincidence that he got all of that right. But the reality is that God's not predicting that any of this is going to happen, nor is God making any of this happen. And it is important to understand prophecy, because guys like Calvin got it all wrong. God is not predicting the future. He is not predestining the future. He is not even orchestrating the future. What God is saying is that I have witnessed the future, and I am reporting to you what's going to happen. And I have done this throughout human history, giving you constant reports of future history so that you can look at the thousands upon thousands of things that I have reported back to you in your past about your future that were going to occur. So when they occur, you would be able to use reason to recognize that this wasn't just a series of improbable coincidences, that I have actually proved my existence, and I proved that I authored the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, so that now, based upon those proofs, you might search them, observe them, consider them, and respond to the offers that I am making in them, because my offers are as trustworthy. My promise of the covenant and its benefits are as trustworthy as were my reports of future history. So more than any other day, the fourth epoch of creation serves as a lesson to me. This is a day that I learned a great deal about how to deal with Scripture. As a Christian in my past, I tried to skirt around, justify, twist. I mean, particularly when you have to deal with Paul. You get conditioned to ignoring lots of things. You get, like, when you're a Christian, you will have discussions about, I wonder what the thorn in Paul's side was. And you will ignore the fact that Paul explained what the thorn in his side was, which was he was demon-possessed, even though that's what he said. You just get conditioned to try to twist or manipulate evidence so that either you ignore it or you twist it to deal with internal conflicts. And so that was my initial approach to this material in Genesis 4. You know, I was researching Islam at the time. I was just beginning to know Yahweh. I was just coming to understand his Torah and his covenant. And you know, kind of like Moshe, in a way. I mean, I'm not comparing myself to Moshe in terms of status by no means. It's just there's a similar aspect of our mission that I want to share with you, which is that when Yahweh approached Moshe and said, hey, I've got a job I'd like you to do with me, Moshe didn't know Yahweh from Adam. Literally, he had no clue. Didn't know his name. Didn't know his Torah. I mean, he didn't know who he was. And so God introduced himself to him and said, we're going to go do this together. Don't worry about it. You know, we're going to do this together. Well, when I began the initial mission, which was to expose and condemn Islam, I was responding to a request that Yahweh made. And at that point, I didn't know his name was Yahweh. I had heard and read Yahweh, but I mean, that wasn't necessarily correct. It wasn't a big deal to me. And I was kind of like Moshe. I said, hey, wait a minute, there's a lot of people that are qualified to do this. I'm not qualified. Go find somebody else, please. But that is the nature of God. He's very often will reach out to someone who doesn't really know him. And over the process of working together, comes to know him. And that was the case of my case in writing Prophet of Doom, Tea with Terrace, and then of beginning my work on Yada Yada. It was a journey to get to know him. And so I was really thrown back by the atheist arguments against the creation account, because I was reading a number of books written by atheists to expose Islam. Didn't find them particularly helpful. It's interesting that atheists and agnostics can present things that are wrong with the religion, but they never come to understand it. But anyway, I read a number of them in my approach to Islam. And one of them was trying to be even-handed and decided that yeah, it's true that Muhammad's creation accounts and the Quran's creation accounts are just contradictory and stupid. But this particular author said, but you know, so is the Torah's creation account, where plants are created on the third day and the sun is created on the fourth day. And so I spent a considerable amount of time trying to deal with that. So first, you know, he said that that astronomy and the fossil record prove that the universe and the earth are billions of years old, not 6,000 years old. And since I saw now Yom as being a period of time, I was managed to kind of step aside of that. But then when he made the big deal about the fourth day was out of order because plants could not have been created on the third day and survive without the sun, yeah, that was a problem. Now, while the atheist position was based upon a misrepresentation of the Bereth testimony, I didn't realize it at the time because I was not, at the time, studying Hebrew. I had not yet come to recognize that English Bible translations are hopelessly errant. Didn't know that at the time. Not comfortable with the thought that God could be wrong, I immersed myself in volumes upon volumes of scholarly commentaries on Genesis. Over the course of that study, I came to see the stories of creation and the flood as prehistory. They became symbolic revelations, focused more on God's kind of overall panorama than events that actually happened. They were the why God created and flooded, not how and when he did these things. The fourth day, I reckoned, was purposefully set out of order, specifically designed to tell us when at that time I would have called him the Christ. Now I know him as the Messiah, the work of Yah, would arrive. I saw the plan of 6+1 revealed in the creation account as providing a framework which we could evaluate history, but I had no way to ascribe that to the Moed Mikre and to what would happen in terms of the fulfillment of the first Moed on the fourth millennium of human history with the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuot, the first four Moed in the fourth millennium of history. Didn't have the capacity to understand any of that. But when my sons chose to become mechanical engineers and biochemists, and at the time they went to Cambridge for a summer study program, and one had the opportunity to study relativity under one of Stephen Hawking's proteges. My perspective was broadened. Both demonstrated a proclivity for relativity over quantum mechanics. One of their favorite conversational topics became the unification of Yahweh's teachings, which we were beginning to study, with observed reality. Their insights were brilliant, but try as they would, I was just too dense to appreciate Einstein. In fact, it wasn't until I came to understand the nature of light from Yah's perspective that I actually came to understand and appreciate Einstein's theory of relativity. And so when we return to Shattering Myths, I will continue to share with you my error, the mistaken way of my past, and how that actually led to a journey of understanding. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about my journey from religion to reason. It was a long one. It's one of the reasons why I'm quite sympathetic of those who are engaged in the same journey. I'm not overly sympathetic of those who are still lost in the world of religion, but of those who have been stained and sullied by religion and have not exercised their nesama, their ability to reason in some time since I struggled with this. I still struggle with it from time to time. I am quite sympathetic. Now, becoming ever more cognizant of the majesty of Yahweh's testimony, because I was spending more time in it, my biochemist son did his best to enlighten dear old dad, albeit chuckling under his breath. Fortunately, about this time, I stumbled upon a Scientific American issue dedicated entirely to the ongoing debate between quantum theory and relativity. And I became a beneficiary of a book on relativity edited by Hawking. Read them cover to cover, time and time again. Better still, a friend loaned me a copy of his The Science of God, which was written by someone who is unfortunately enveloped in rabbinical Judaism, in fact even favors Kabbalah. But it was written by a physicist. Schroeder is the man's name. And he was the first, to my knowledge, to apply relativity to the Genesis, the Bereshith Torah testimony. And so little by little, I began to understand. Yet it was not enough. It wasn't until I was encouraged to translate Yah's testimony, scripture, directly from the Hebrew, and then reflect on what God actually revealed, that I finally came to appreciate just how right and wrong I had been all the time. I was wrong because I sold God short. Scientifically, the 6 days of creation are perfectly accurate in time and sequence and in substance. If you look at what God said happened on each of the 6 days in time, in sequence, and in substance, in every area that matters, that is exactly what occurred. It's when it occurred. It's how long it took to occur. It is what occurred. Moreover, while the creation account provides a human historical framework, it's much more than just 6 millennia plus 1. Every day is correlated to man's existence as it is recorded both independently and scripturally. Baal Rishith provides the framework upon which all prophecy hangs. And while I recognized that the message embedded in the fourth day and the seventh days provided a significant insight into Yahweh's overall plan of salvation, I had yet to come to appreciate that every day contains a redemptive lesson, as do all other scriptural references to creation. Yes, the seventh day is the seventh millennia of human existence outside of the garden, where we return to the garden for 1,000 years. And the fourth day is when the greater light, the Masiah Yahusha, would be revealed to us as a sign of the Moed, which are the meetings with God, where he fulfilled the first four on the fourth, the last day, the last year, I should say, of the fourth millennia of human existence outside of the garden. Yes, the story all fits. So the moral of the story is, at least for me, and I hope for you, God is really smart. He knows what he's talking about. I'm not, and often don't. Yah was perfect, and I make mistakes. So keep that in mind as you continue to listen to whatever commentary I might have about his scripture. My commentary is designed only to encourage you to pause and reflect on what God has revealed. I do it so that you have interesting related statements that God has made to help connect the dots, thereby helping to frame a more complete picture, perhaps even broadening your perspective a bit. But never lose track of the fact that I'm learning and discovering right along with you. I do not know quite often what a passage is going to reveal until I jump right into the middle of it. And I allow the Spirit and the words to guide me. I don't even know the next passage that I'm going to amplify before we begin that process. I believe that one of the lessons I was encouraged to embark on, one of the, I guess the reasons I should say that I was encouraged to embark on this task, was because that I recognize that I am unqualified and I am willing to admit it. And in turn, that made me reliant. And that's right where God wants us to be. It's another comparison I can make to Moshe. Moshe recognized that he was unqualified, and that made him perfect for the job. Well, I don't claim to be perfect for this job. I am willing to admit that I am unqualified, which means that I have to be reliant. I'm Yada. We'll be back after the commercial break. To Shattering Myths. We're about to begin the fifth day of creation. The first statement that God says is, "And God said, let the waters teem with creatures, living souls." So according to what can be deduced from scripture and relativity, the fifth day dawned approximately 900 million years ago and closed 450 million years in our past. At this time, God's testimony reveals that animal life flourished, and it began in the sea. So here's the testimony. And God said, let the Waters team. This is Saros. Conceive, swarm, and multiply. With creatures, this is Theres, which would be insects and animals. Living, which is the Hebrew word che, souls, nephesh. Now, before we ponder the implications of this, we had a caller last week that was interested in how many messengers, how many Moloch God may have had. So we kind of got a feeling as to how many Moloch there are working still for Yahweh versus the Moloch that are now fallen and working with Satan. Moloch is the Hebrew word for messenger. It is the agelos is the Greek word for messenger. And so in English, we've transliterated the Greek word agelos to angel as opposed to messenger. And so, you know, my thought was tens of thousands, but, you know, I really don't know the number. And so there were two passages that seem to provide some quantification of how many there are. There's only two. One is in a revelation that's contained in the midst of Daniel, and it's in the midst of some very symbolic terminology in a transition where Daniel is talking about the four empires that are going to subjugate the earth over periods of time, and then the transition to the Son of Man, the Messiah's arrival, and then he in that context speaks of quantity, but it's very, very difficult to know what he is quantifying with that quantity. So that wasn't of significant help. And then in Revelation, fairly early in Revelation, fifth chapter, somewhere around there, Yahochanan is given access to Yahweh's home, and he hears voices around the throne. And the voice is actually a singular voice, so it's written as a singular voice, and he is quantifying that voice. And it's the voice, and then he has three groups of individuals, if you will, that are collectively creating this singular voice, and these individuals are the Moloch, which would be Yah's spiritual messengers, living creatures, which is very similar to this, living creatures, Che Sheres, and the third would be elders, and don't know who the elders are, and obviously we know who the Moloch are, Yah's spiritual messengers, and it then quantified the voice, not the number of any one of these individual things, and it was in the range of 100 million and a million when you did the math. And the reason I'm bringing this up is, first of all, to lay to rest the question that was asked a week ago as to how many. The answer is God didn't tell us, so we don't know. But that God created living souls, animals which have souls. There is, in religion in particular, there is a great misunderstanding of the nature of souls and who has a soul. Scott was sharing with me, I think it was Scott, this battle between rival a Catholic church and a Protestant church in a town, and the Catholic church said that all dogs go to heaven, and the Protestant church billboard then the next week said dogs don't have souls. Well, dogs do have souls. All animals have souls according to God. And a matter of fact, just according to observation, we should come to the conclusion that the thing that makes animals different than plant life is that all animals are able to observe and react and respond to their environment. That's what makes animals different than plants. We're able to observe and respond and react to our environment. It is our consciousness, our soul, our nefesh, that enables us to do that. All animals have souls. God specifically says that man has a soul. So, we are trying to think about what would we expect these living souls to be in heaven? And then I began to think a little bit more, and I said, okay, there is a story that there's only one example that Yahweh provides us with of a conversation that he had with Adam in the garden. And what was that conversation about?
He introduced the animals and told them what the animals were and things like that.
Exactly. I say, aren't these things neat? Look, I created a platypus. I created this bird. I created, you know, this parrot. Isn't that magnificent? And God was very excited to share with Adam the animals that he had created. So doesn't it make some sense to you, since he's telling us in Revelation, and he tells us also in Ezekiel and Daniel, that there's these living souls in heaven, that maybe heaven is going to be made richer by the existence of the animals that God has created?
Well, we also talked about there's another story where he goes out of his way to take care of animals as well.
Yeah.
The ark.
Exactly.
You know. Gather up animals and bring them with you, you know.
Right. Yeah, I created these. I'm pleased with having created them. They have souls. And these add value to life. But you know, part of the great, you know, when we go off and explore the universe with Yahweh, a universe deprived of living creatures isn't going to be nearly as interesting as one with life, right? So I'm suggesting that the living souls that Yahweh has created are going to share our eternity with us, as opposed to God saying, okay, the only one I'm going to keep here is man. That's the only soul, and the rest of the souls can just go away.
Well, it doesn't make sense either, because, I mean, we when we talked about it, it was us that talked about this. When we talked about it, animal is not inherently malicious.
No.
You know, they just don't do things that are just mean for the sake of being mean, which is something that a person can.
Right. Yeah, they don't try to deceive.
Yeah. I mean, an animal doesn't just try to deceive you. If you're out in the wild and you come across a lion, it's not just going to, like, randomly, you know, you're going to have a lot of signs there that tell you that thing, you know, might be attacking you soon.
Yeah, but for only one reason. It's not that it doesn't like you.
Yeah, but he's going to eat you.
Yeah, that's right. It's hungry. And now, do I think that it will be possible for God to have in eternity a different process by which animals are nourished because we're going to be living in a spiritual realm? Absolutely. But wouldn't eternity be deprived of the most exciting things to enjoy, just like Yahweh and Adam looked at and talked about the animals? Wouldn't a eternity with only one form of life be less exciting than if it was filled with life?
Wouldn't your daily life right now be boring without having other things? If all you saw was people all day, that's
right.
I mean, I have a dog. I love my dog.
Yeah.
My dog is great. I didn't come home every day and watch my dog spin around in circles, you know, to greet me, my day wouldn't be nearly as good.
Yep, I've got a mallard that loves my swimming pool, and a whole bunch of red-headed hummingbirds that just love the trees that are right outside of my window here. And yes, they make the view more interesting. And I think that we're going to get to experience creatures with living souls beyond our earthly constraints.
It's like you said, though, he went out of his way to explain the animals. It wasn't, right. You know, he didn't, like, go to Adam, hey, look at that sun. I did that.
Look at this rock. Isn't this rock an interesting composition of minerals?
You see that mountain over there? All me, you know.
Yeah, all of me. You know, and by the way, he may have said, hey, wow, look at that mountain over there. There may have been a mountain in Eden. I really don't know. But the fact is, he tells us one story, and nothing God does is perchance. There's a reason he told us that one story. That he actually told us two stories. One is that he walked in the morning, which tells you that he and Adam had a relationship where they walked together. They enjoyed one another's company as companions, as friends, not as this idea of God subject. And the other is that, well, let's sit down and let's talk about the animals. Let's talk about life. Let's talk about these living souls.
And, I mean, some of that could have came from Adam's questions himself. I mean,
right. And, you know, we're told that in the millennial Shabbat, that the lion and the lamb will lie down together. We're told that, which means that there will be lions and lambs during the millennial Shabbat. And the millennial Shabbat is a parable, if you will. Well, it's true. It's going to happen. It's real. But it is a word picture of what eternity is going to be like. The Garden of Eden is a parable of what the millennial Shabbat is going to be like. And that millennial Shabbat, our seventh day together on earth, where God turns the whole earth back into the conditions of experience in the Garden of Eden and lives with us, that is a word picture of exactly what eternity is going to be like. And we not only find animals in both places, but we find God talking about life. Something to think about. You know, it's like so many of the things that we share on this program. Not saying that this interpretation is the only one that is possible, but it certainly is possible, is it not? The final segment of Shattering Myths for today. We'll continue this discussion about the fifth day tomorrow. God's opening statement on the fifth day of creation is, and God said, let the waters teem, let them saras, conceive, swarm, and multiply with creatures, seres, insects, and animals, living souls. And living is from che, souls is from nefesh. God created the proper environment and recipe for life and then gave his creation a free hand. According to his testimony, the miracle of creation is in the calculation, the composition and tuning of the energy and matter formulated on day one, and then in the development of DNA, the language of life, the blueprint for life. Once these things were accomplished, nature, like man, was free to run its course. And so when we talk about acts of God, they're not acts of God. God created the amount of energy to conceive a universe and life within it, just as we witness, but he has given that universe a free hand. There, up to this point, there has been only one use of the word bara, which is to create, and it was on day one. God released the energy that became light, and light then through organization became matter. And so God is telling us that he is a proponent of free will, even when it relates to nature itself. He is not a micromanager. So in this statement, we learn that a nefesh soul or consciousness is not unique or distinctive to humankind. All animals, even insects, have a nefesh soul. Now, God gave Adam something that was unique, that caused Adam to be more in the image of God than strictly a living soul. So we do have something beyond a soul. But that, by the way, is not spirit. You also hear so many people talk about the human spirit. There is no human spirit. There is a human consciousness or soul, and there's also a human conscience, which is a nesoma, conscience. That is the uniqueness of humankind. It's the only thing that makes humankind distinct among the animals, other than our design in terms of being an upright creature that can stand, having hands with opposable thumbs that can grasp hold of things. The fact that as mammals, the way that we uniquely build homes and through marriages raise our children, there are aspects of humankind by design that were specifically conceived by Yahweh to help us understand his covenant, his family-oriented relationship, and his role as father, and ours as children in his family. And the whole concept of covenant, which is based upon the notion of home, and that God's primary interest, I mentioned this in the beginning of the program, is for us to walk with him, halak in Hebrew. And so all of that plays into our physical design, but in terms of the uniqueness of humankind, the primary uniqueness is that we were given a nesoma, conscience. Otherwise, we are the same as the animals. We were comprised of the same material, and we all have a soul. According to Yahweh, and complicit with science, animals and insects were initially conceived in water. In our Genesis, we are all alike, comprised and composed of the elements of the earth and born in the seas. It should be noted that while consciousness is the determining factor between animals and plant life, there are no serious scientific studies designed to ascertain the nature of consciousness. We recognize that it exists, but we are clueless as to what it is, how it works, where it comes from during conception, or where it goes upon death. Many of those listening to this program know that my mother-in-law recently passed, and my wife was sitting beside her on her bed as she breathed her last breath, holding her hand. At one moment, she was there. The next, she was not. The physical body, nothing different. But the consciousness, the soul, was there one moment, and it was gone the next. Science has no idea whatsoever what this soul is. God told us about it. He told us its purpose, which is so that we can be observant, so that we come to know and understand who he is, and then respond, the ability to respond to what he is offering. This has been Shattering Myths. I look forward to sharing Yah's testimony with you tomorrow.
Hello?
Congratulations.
For what?
For losing all that weight. How'd you do it so fast?
ASAP.
ASAP what? What's that mean?
Are you ready to get as skinny as possible?